One November day in 2002, Jim Sulkers, a 53-year-old retired municipal worker from Winnipeg, climbed into bed, pulled the covers up, and died, according to Maclean's magazine. Nearly 2 years later, on August 25, 2004, police who had been called by concerned relatives entered Sulker's apartment and found his body in a mummified state. Everything else in his tidy one-bedroom apartment was intact, although the food in the fridge was spoiled and his wall calendar was 2 years out of date. Mr. Sulker's death went undiscovered for 2 years for several reasons. He was reclusive. He was estranged from his family members, and he had a medical condition that prevented his body from decomposing and emitting any odors. In addition, automatic banking deposited his disability pension and withdrew his utilities and other expenses and paid all of his bills as they came due. In essence, Jim Sulkers remained virtually alive as far as the community was concerned. But this virtual reality, it's not real community, is it? I wonder how many Jim Sulkers there are in our churches. People who are living a virtual reality in our communities of faith, but who really have no in-depth relationships, no relational connectedness that they can count on in church. It's important to come to church on Sunday mornings. It's important to worship together, to listen to a sermon, to sing together, to greet one another as we always do. But if that is all you gain from church, if that is all church is to you, then you have missed a vital New Testament element of Christianity, of faith. It is biblical community. And if that's all we're about, we have missed it as a church. So as we come to the end of our study of the book of Titus, Paul emphasizes for us the truth that Christianity compels community. Christianity compels community. Last June at our annual elders' retreat, we prayerfully came to the conclusion that we needed to rebuild a sense of community at Galilee. That this is an area we really need to work on. And that's why we've decided to remain at one service this fall and why we're seeking ways to emphasize our community of faith in the days ahead. Healthy Christians cannot live in isolation very well at all. And local churches need to be true communities of faith. And it goes both ways. You need people. You need the church, and the church needs you in this community of faith. So let's take a look at Paul's words about his first century relationships and explore a little bit this morning about what it means to live in community with other believers. Principle number one this morning from Titus chapter 3 and verse 12. Everyone needs someone. Everyone needs someone. Look at verse 12. When I send Artemas or Tychicus to you, make every effort to come to me at Nicopolis, for I have decided to spend the winter there. Now, I enjoy reading the conclusions to Paul's letters because we get little glimpses into his circle of relationships at the ends of his letters. Every letter seems to end with some of these people and these relationships. Paul traveled, of course, all over the Mediterranean world, establishing local churches, but he always had a circle of friends who were closely involved with him in the ministry. And we read in this verse about three people who were closely connected with Paul. We don't know much about the first man, Artemas. Church tradition says that Artemas went on to become bishop or pastor of Lystra in what is modern-day Turkey. Tychicus has been one of Paul's partners in the ministry for a dozen years at this time. He was an Asian believer who was one of the men Paul used in his delegation to Jerusalem a decade earlier, and he has been partnering with Paul over all this time. Tychicus was also the man that Paul used to mediate the dispute between the slave Onesimus and the slave owner Philemon, who were Christians. And it was Tychicus that Paul sent to mediate that whole dispute. So he has been a partner with Paul for many years. We learn that Paul plans to spend his winter at Nicopolis, a city which was on the shores of the Adriatic Sea. He planned to send either Artemas or Tychicus to relieve Titus as pastor of the church on the island of Crete. But we find out from 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 12 that he actually sends Tychicus to Ephesus, which to help Timothy there. So we understand that Artemas was probably the man that was sent to the island of Crete to relieve Titus. But what I want you to notice is the urgency of Paul's request here. Actually, it's in the command form of the Greek text. He wants Titus to hurry and come to him for the winter. Urgently. There's urgency here. The letter of Titus was probably written in the late summer months, and the seas would close for traffic for the winter. So if he was going to come, he had to come before winter started in the Mediterranean. And he wanted Paul wanted Titus urgently to make arrangements to join him in the city of Nicopolis for the winter. He needed Titus, in other words. And Paul wanted Titus because Titus was one of his closest friends in the ministry. And apparently Paul was having a difficult time right now as he prepared to winter. Titus was an uncircumcised Greek. He was not a Jew. He was Paul's test case 14 years earlier when Paul went to the Jerusalem church. He was Paul's test case about whether an uncircumcised person could be a Christian or not. And ever since, he's been one of Paul's trusted partners. Now Paul needed his good friend to join him for the winter so they could strengthen one another in the faith. Think about Paul in this situation. He needed Titus. God intended us to live in groups, to have relationships, not to live in isolation. And even a great man of faith like Paul needed someone by his side in the ministry. Paul couldn't go it alone. Neither can you. Neither can I. Everyone needs someone. If you think of Paul's relationships as sort of a set of concentric circles, you'll get the idea of biblical community as it's played out in the New Testament. So the outer circle of Paul's relationships, think of all of the churches that he has established around the Mediterranean world, the Roman world. Believers in all of these churches, they're part of his outer circle. He has relationships with them. Then you think of the next circle inside that outer circle. And he has fellowship with the leaders of these churches. He's written letters to many of them. Many of the letters we have in the New Testament, for they were inspired by the Holy Spirit of God. But there are other letters that he wrote to these leaders that we do not have today. They are not part of the New Testament. Paul had relationships with the leaders of all of these churches. But then the next circle inside of that was a group of about 12 individuals that Paul mentions. that are partnering with him in various ways over the years in ministry, and we see their names sometimes repeatedly in the New Testament. We read of Barnabas and Silas. We read of John Mark and Apollos and Aquila and Priscilla and Tychicus and Artemis and others that Paul was partnering with over the years. And finally we come to Paul's inner circle, that core group close to him. And that seems to be Luke, the physician, the medical doctor and writer who's with Paul through all of the tough times. Seems to be the young pastor that he's mentoring, Timothy, that he writes to repeatedly and cares for, and his colleague, Titus. Luke, Timothy, Titus. Here's the inner core. That's biblical community. There's the outer ring. Fellowship with believers in a worship service. We know one another to the point where we can celebrate the Lord together. But then there's an inner circle of people. Jesus would follow the same pattern. There were the crowds. Then there were the 70 disciples. Then there were the 12 disciples. And then there were the 3 disciples. Same pattern, you see. And every Christian needs similar patterns in their lives. So we gather in worship with large groups. That's fine. But then there are those who we're involved with in ministry, and then there are those who are closer to us, and then there's those 2 or 3 people that are our trusted inner, they are with us in the tough times, and they know us well. See, the early church in Acts chapter 2 worshiped together in the temple complex, large crowds of people. In fact, first day, 3,000 people in the church of Jerusalem. 3,000 new believers, members. So you know this church was huge. This was the first mega church. Okay? But then they served together, Acts 2 tells us, in various ways and in small group settings. And then they ate meals together with one another in the homes. Community involves then worshiping together, serving together, and eating meals together in fellowship. Now let's look at community in the context of our church here. Folks, if you are not involved in a small group ministry and a small group fellowship, home fellowship, and a ministry in the church, guess what? You're going to feel very disconnected over time. It's just going to be the reality. If you're not connected with people in a fellowship group, and you're not involved with people partnering in some ministry, you're going to feel disconnected. Just coming to worship on Sunday mornings won't meet your need for community. Now, we have many ministries to choose from. We have many groups to be a part of based upon your background, your personality, your gifts. Nobody connects equally with everybody. We all have personalities. We all have backgrounds. Our personalities and backgrounds form common bonds with some people, not so common with others. That's real. That's the way it is. It's not wrong at all. It's very normal. Recently, I heard some of our founding members getting together for a time of fellowship. That's great. That's wonderful. You folks who are part of the founding of this church in 1975, you have a common bond that none of the rest of us will ever share. We can't. That goes back 30 years. So that's a partnership. That's a fellowship. Those are connections. If you wonder where you fit in, then speak to Pastor Tom or me. We'll see where we can place you in the circles of relationships that exist, or we'll start a new one. But it's essential that we make these connections. Everyone needs someone. One writer who works with a men's ministry, said that as he talks with men about their struggles, he said, "I realize many men are languishing because nobody is recognizing the noble things in their life. Men need male cheerleaders. If no one cheers for nobility, men are going to collapse back into a dumbed-down masculinity that follows the cheers of the world's obsessive careerism, selfish pursuits, and ignoble needs. We need to try to cheer men on for the right things." And that's why he works in men's ministries. Men need people. They need other men in their lives. That's a reality. He had one man tell him, "I'm old, I'm sick, I have no purpose in life." He said to the man, no, that's not true at all. You've got a lot of things you can do." And the man said, "Like what?" He said, "Tell younger men your story." He said, "Nobody would want to listen to me." This man's leader said, "You've got 70 years of experience, and here's a generation of guys who haven't had anybody to share real life with them." Yeah, he sputtered. He said, "Well, okay, if one of them really wants to talk with me, I guess we could get together." So this men's leader went to the men's meeting short time after that, and he told them the story of this man because they were talking about teamwork, and young guys came up to him after the meeting and they said, we want to get together with this man. And to this day, the older man meets with 5 or 6 men every week, and he has a waiting list of men who want to be connected with him. Everyone needs someone. Second lesson we learn about community. Missionaries need our support. Missionaries need our support. Look at verse 13. "Diligently help Zenas the lawyer and Apollos on their way so that nothing is lacking for them." Here we meet 2 more of Paul's circle of friends. Apollos is fairly well known in the New Testament. He was a Jew from Alexandria, Egypt, who was very gifted as a public speaker and a teacher. He was particularly gifted at explaining the Old Testament Hebrew scriptures as a scholarly Christian. He was a scholarly individual. Some believe that Apollos might well have been the author of the book of Hebrews, for example, in the New Testament. Very possible. Zenas is not as well known. He's described here as a lawyer, which could mean that he was an expert in Mosaic law or that he was an expert in Roman law. We don't really know which lawyer he was. Late tradition says that he became bishop of Lydda, pastor of the church in Lydda, which is a town in central Palestine. The town was burned down by the Romans under Emperor Nero, later rebuilt and became a study for the center of Jewish law. A rabbinic study center developed in this town that was well known, very large, and as well as a large Christian church, which apparently Zenas pastored. Now, we're not told where Paul was sending these 2 men. They were on their way through Crete. But a good guess would be back to Alexandria, Egypt, as missionaries. Alexandria, Egypt was the center of a huge population of Jewish people. Alexandria, Egypt was a cosmopolitan city, but it had a huge university, one of the best known universities in the Roman world, with a very large school of law, Jewish law and Greco-Roman law. Apollos and Zenas would have been excellent missionaries to send to a place like that, gifted with the ability to think and communicate that comes from being trained as legal scholars and experts in the Old Testament as well. But what we are told here is that it was the job of the church on the island of Crete to do what? Help them on their way. Help them on their way. The Greek word translated help is a command. The word meant to escort someone or to furnish what someone needed to complete a task. It was used of escorting a departing traveler on his way to a destination by giving him whatever he needed to get on his way. It was used of supplying money for the material needs of the trip. But it's not just money that the word involved or possessions. It's the emotional support and the prayer support that the church needs to provide. Paul emphasized this by his words at the end of this verse. He said, you are to supply them so that nothing is lacking for them. The word lacking means left behind. When people leave on a task, such as missionaries, they leave behind. And whatever they're left behind, the church needs to help provide for them as they move on their way. Obviously, Zenas and Apollos could not take all their belongings with them as they traveled, so the church was to supply what they had left behind. Missionaries need our support. They can't do it alone. But it's not just money. It's that support system, those friends, those colleagues, those partners that helped us when we had needs. They leave those behind too. In this day and age, we have many capacities for sort of helping that. But I remember talking with Jen May this summer, and she was sharing with me about that's one of her greatest concerns was she has a core group of people here, and she's leaving them behind as she goes to Guatemala. And that's a struggle. Yeah, you can stay connected, but not quite the same, is it? And she was very concerned about that, and that was one of her primary prayer requests. As she left behind these people who were so much a part of her life. You see, community involves the power of teamwork to get a job done. So we have a duty to help the three missionaries from our church get supported. We've got Jen May in Guatemala who's gone out there. We have Mark Wagaman sitting right here who's seeking support to get on with his work. Well, he's already doing his work with Delta, but juggling and flipping hats all the time is tough. And we have Dan Clark, who's away this weekend once again, as they are going to Brazil, as they are seeking to get out there. It's the job of the church to come together and support them, to help them on their way, just as it was in Crete. Through our prayers, our gifts, our financial assistance, our letters, our encouragement. All right, that's the second principle of community. Third principle. Our mission is to meet needs, verse 14. Our mission is to meet needs. Every community needs to be supporting one another in various ways and must have a common purpose or mission. Yesterday, I went to the Bonnie Eagle Gorham football game. Oh, must be from Gorham. Everybody from Bonnie Eagle's cheering because Bonnie Eagle won big yesterday over, and they're undefeated. But what happens, it always strikes me as I walk into these things, because you see neighbors, and you see family members, and you see people, and you stand with other people that, well, you know, I don't see them in many other contexts of life, but I see them in any connection with the school, right? And the community that lives in that area. And you stand and you talk and you cheer. And the football players are out there playing their hearts out. And the coaches are coaching away on the sidelines. And the fans are cheering. Why? We've got a common purpose. We've got to win, right? That's the common purpose. Well, the church is not that much different. Community means that people are supporting one another in a common cause. Okay? Using, some of us are cheering, some of us are praying, some of us are encouraging, some of us are doing, all of these kinds of aspects, but we're in a common cause. What's the common cause? Well, it's a theme of Titus. In verse 14, we've seen it before. He's repeating it here. He says, "And let our people also learn to engage in good works, good deeds, to meet pressing needs, that they may not be unfruitful." This is a theme throughout Titus. We've seen it before. Christians are most productive when they focus on meeting the needs of people. Paul wants to make sure that the Christians in the church on Crete learn to prioritize excellent works. The word for engage means to prefer or value above other kinds of activities. The priorities for Christians living in communities of faith, the priority is not politics. The priority is not buildings. The priority is not programs. The priority is not organizations. The priority is not properties. What's the priority? It's people. It's always people that are ultimately the highest priority. It's not to say that these other things aren't important or aren't good or aren't valuable. They are. They're all part of what we need to be doing. But they're not the priority. The priority is people and their needs. That takes precedence over everything else. Paul tells Titus here that this process of prioritizing the pressing needs, those things that really weigh hard on somebody, that process of learning to prioritize those things is a learned process. Let our people learn. The word for learn is the word for disciple. Let our people learn to do this. Why does he say it that way? Because it doesn't come naturally. We have to learn how to do this. It's not the natural response that we have. We have to learn to set some things above others as a matter of priority. We're coming up on our annual meeting. Every budget is a set of priorities for a church for that year. Where we spend our money tells what is most important, more important to us, and every budget is a process of deciding between various priorities that every church has to balance. Now, I wish that God just gave us everything we wanted so we could do everything. Right? You wish that for your families too, right? But He doesn't. And so we end up with this balancing of priorities in that process. Paul tells us that when we have to choose between people and property, we choose people. When we have to choose between people and politics, we choose people. When we have to choose between people and programs, we choose people. And what are the needs? And we're not always so good at doing that. It's a learned prioritizing process. It doesn't come naturally. Our mission is to meet the pressing needs of our people. Now, no single pastor can do that. It takes a whole church community to meet the needs of others. The pastor, he's limited. Believe me, he's limited. He doesn't have the energy, the skill, the time, or even the gifts to meet every need. Many in the congregation have gifts that the pastor does not have that can meet the needs of others in that congregation. That's why community is formed, when everyone takes on the mission of meeting needs in that community. That mission then bonds people together in ways that no other process can accomplish. When we love one another, it shows and it draws us together in a common cause of meeting the pressing needs of people. Anna had never felt so alone. Her husband, Herman, needed minor surgery to repair a hernia. But the fact that he also suffered from Alzheimer's made it anything but minor. The doctor had just visited Herman's room, informed her that after surgery they'd have to put her husband in arm and leg restraints because they were afraid that he might pull out the IVs or become disoriented or try to do various things because of his Alzheimer's. And, oh, it hit her. It's hard to think and imagine her husband in arm and leg restraints. She didn't know what she was going to do. Just about that time, there was a knock on the door, and Mike and Carol, who were 30 years younger, but over the last few years, they had been involved together in a home fellowship group, along with a number of other people. And they came to visit Herman and Anna in the hospital that day. They quickly recognized that Anna was concerned and struggling about some things, and so they eventually got it out of her what was going on. Mike and Carol didn't know what to do either, but they said, hey, we're on our way to the home fellowship group that we're meeting with tonight, and we'll share it and we'll pray with you. So they left. About an hour later, the phone rang and Anna picked it up. Oh, good, you're still here. It was Carol on the other end. After we prayed for you tonight, someone asked why they couldn't just have the nurses keep an eye on Herman, so I explained what was going on and why they couldn't do that. They didn't have the staff to do that. And somebody else said, well, why don't we do that from our home fellowship group? Would they let us do that in the hospital? Anna, could you go to the nurse's station and ask them if he would have to be in arm and leg restraints if someone was with him all the time? From our home fellowship group, because we'd like to do that. She said, I can't ask you to do that. I can't ask you. You're not asking. We're offering, they said. So she went to the nurse's station. She said, if somebody came and was here all the time, the nurse said, that's fine. That's fine. If somebody's there, he won't have to be. So she went back and she said, she gave them the answer, and then she was trying to say to them, but I can't ask you to do that, when she heard the whole group erupt in cheers over the telephone. And that very night, over a dozen people had signed up for round-the-clock shifts. And soon, family and other friends grabbed a hold of the idea. And over the next 3 days, somebody was with Herman and Anna in that hospital room around the clock, until he could be sent to the nursing home. A month or so later, Anna went to the home fellowship group. She tried to express her thanks. You know what? She couldn't even get the words out, because every time she tried to say thank you, she started to cry. But no one in that fellowship group felt it was a major sacrifice. It hadn't taken that much. They were connected. They simply had wanted to help a friend through a tough spot. That group had found the simple power of community. Fourth principle. Loyal friends provide a secure foundation. Verse 15. Loyal friends provide a secure foundation. Paul writes, all who are with me greet you, greet those who love us in the faith, grace be with you all. Very traditional greeting of Paul as he closes his letters from Paul and the people with him, which at this point were probably Luke, maybe a couple of others, but primarily Luke, to Titus and the people in the church on the island of Crete. There's a little twist in this final greeting that we almost miss when we read it over because it seems so traditional. Notice his wording. He said, greet those who love us in faith. Greet those who love us in faith. Now, the definite article is not there in the Greek. It's not the faith. It is in faith, which means it's a quality or a description of the people who love them. It is greet those who love us faithfully or loyally. It's the quality of those who love. It's not everybody. Greet those who love us loyally or faithfully. And earlier he had said, let our people learn, as if there were those in the church who did not fit that description. Think about it. In fact, there were. There were those in the church on Crete who were divisive and antagonistic to Paul. We just read about it in the previous verses. They did not love Paul with a loyal love. This is the tragic aspect of many communities. There will be those who are not faithful in their love. There will always be those who fall away or turn away from God's people. Paul wrote this letter, and then he went to winter in the city of Nicopolis, right? Titus joined him there. The next spring, so perhaps 6-8 months later in Nicopolis, historians believe this is where Paul was arrested for his final Roman imprisonment. He was arrested, taken to Rome, where he would be executed. So less than a year later, he's arrested. And he writes the book of 2 Timothy from the Roman prison cell as he awaits his execution. Now, at the end of the book of 2 Timothy, turn there. The end of the book of 2 Timothy, I think, are some of the saddest words in Scripture from the life of Paul. 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 9. Listen to what Paul writes, perhaps a year later, from Titus. He says, "Make every effort to come to me soon." He's writing to Timothy now. "Because Demas, having loved this present world, has deserted me and gone to Thessalonica. Crescens has gone to Galatia. Titus to Dalmatia. Only Luke is with me. Pick up Mark and bring him with you, for he is useful to me for service. But Tychicus I have sent to Ephesus. When you come, bring the cloak which I left at Troas with Carpus, and the books, especially the parchments. Alexander the coppersmith did me much harm. The Lord will repay him according to his deeds. Be on guard against him yourself, for he vigorously opposed our teaching. At my first defense, no one supported me, but all deserted me. May it not be counted against them. But the Lord stood with me and strengthened me in order that through me the proclamation might be fully accomplished and that all the Gentiles might hear, and I was delivered out of the lion's mouth. The Lord will deliver me from every evil deed and will bring me safely to his heavenly kingdom. To him be the glory forever and ever. Amen. Greet Prisca and Aquila and the household of Onesiphorus. Erastus remained at Corinth, but Trophimus I left sick at Miletus. Make every effort to come before winter." There it is again. Winters must have been hard for Paul. "Make every effort to come before winter. Eubulus greets you also. Pudens and Linus and Claudia and all the brethren, the Lord be with your spirit, grace be with you." Paul felt alone. Demas had deserted him, turned against him. Alexander opposed him, did him much harm. His close friends, except for Luke, were all sent to various assignments or were sick or otherwise involved in ministry. No one even supported him at his first defense before the Roman emperor, the court of Rome, alone. But Titus, Luke, and Timothy were all friends he could count on. He writes to Timothy here. He has Luke with him. Luke at his side during all those dark days in Rome. Stood with him up until the time of his execution. See, loyal friends provide a secure foundation. You don't have hundreds of them. They're rare people. Do you have two or three people in your life who are like that? Who are with you and stick with you when everything else is going wrong? Paul did, and we need them too. Good friends don't let you go when you need them the most. Good friends love you faithfully. Everyone needs a few good, faithful friends. Christianity compels community. This is what community is. Richard Kidd's staff pastor at Kempsville Presbyterian Church in Virginia Beach, Virginia, tells the story that happened to him many years earlier. He was going to William and Mary College, and they had a group of guys that really got together and bonded in the dorm rooms. And they would pray together and they'd laugh together. They had great times together. One year after spring break, he came back. They all came back to the university, and they found out that one of their friends, John Swanson, was in a hospital in Maine after a terrible skiing accident, and he was in a coma. So they began to pray, this group of guys. They prayed with all their might, and then they received a call from the neurologist. The family had told them how to get in touch with these guys at the college. And the neurologist said, "We feel like John's brainstem injury, which has caused this coma, may be helped if he could hear some of the sounds he ordinarily hears. Could you put together a tape of all of John's favorite sounds and send it to us?" So this group of college guys gathered together. They put John's favorite music on it. They told all the bad jokes they ordinarily told when he was there. And they did all the crazy things that college guys do in dorm rooms. They put it all on the tape, and at the end, they prayed fervently for him, and they cried for their friend, their buddy. They sent the tape. When they played that tape for John in his hospital room on the sixth day of his coma, while others were praying, they played that tape, John snapped out of his coma. And though the doctor said he would never walk correctly or go back to school, John Swanson proved him wrong. He even began to run again. He ran 60 miles a week. He graduated from William and Mary and became a personal research assistant for Alan Greenspan. We were in community, says Richard. We were in community, and community did John's body good. Biblical community. It's God's call for our lives here.